Is this another financial crisis, do you think?
I think the quick answer is no.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In this episode, the impact of the war in Ukraine on global financial stability.
Now, because it's not a financial crisis, it doesn't mean that it's not going to have impact on the economy, though, right? So there are huge uncertainties, and there are significant implications for the global economy. My name is Fabio Nadalucci. I'm a deputy director in the Monetary and Capital Markets Department at the International Monetary Fund. I'm responsible for the Global Financial Stability Report, one of the flagship of the IMF that gets released during the spring and annual meetings, as well as the IMF Global Financial Markets Monitoring.
So you've done a lot of global financial stability reports over the years and during some tough times. How does this one compare?
Yeah, so this is a good question, right? So this is the third shock in about 15 years that we have been asking this question. One was the financial crisis, 2008, 2009. Then we had COVID about 2 years ago, and now we get this, the war and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Now, there are three different shocks. The source of the shock is different. The GFC was a financial shock. Then we have the pandemic, and now this is a war, and operates through different channels. But ultimately, the question that we ask where I sit is whether this is a global financial crisis and what through which channel it would work. I think the quick answer is that this is not a systemic event, at least so far, affecting markets and financial institutions. In part, this reflects the increased resilience of the global financial system post-financial crisis in 2007, 2008. So we have stronger banking systems, higher capital, higher liquidity. We also have increased the resilience of the important nodes in the financial system. So thinking about derivatives, central clearing, and so on. So the financial system is stronger, it's more resilient, and it has seemed so far, at least, has been able to absorb the shock of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Now, that said, financial stability risks have been rising along many dimensions. And in fact, may down the road, depending on how the war proceeds, whether there is an intensification of the war or the sanction, test the resilience of the global financial system, right? So we have been seeing crystallizing specific channels of transmission that are very much unique to this crisis, right? And I think the reason being that looking back 15 years, if you look at these three shock financial crises, COVID and the war now, they are different shock. One is a financial shock back in the GFC, then we had a pandemic, and now we have a war. And so for us, the challenge was, as we were writing the GFSR, how to think about this this shock here, what format in the Global Financial Stability Report was appropriate, and particularly think about new transmission channel of this shock. And so we focus on the exposure of banks and non-bank financial sector, both direct and indirect exposures. We focus on disruption in commodity markets, surging commodity prices. And this was, in some sense, this is the new channel, an important channel that reverberates through the global financial system. We focus on counterparty risk, in part related to disruption in commodities market, and how that's led to strains in funding markets and liquidity deterioration. We looked at the removal of Russian debt and equity securities from indices, risk of possible Russian default, cryptoization of emerging markets, cyber events, essentially different channel that could transmit this this shock through the financial system.
So like you say, I mean, crisis or not, there are a lot of things to worry about, and you've listed several of them right there. But what about things like inflation? I mean, other than the obvious impact on our pocketbooks, does the record high inflation we're seeing today pose a financial stability risk?
Right, so let's start maybe focusing on the U.S. for a second, right, as an example where some of the market attention has been lately, and then see maybe how this can be broadened to other countries, right? So what we're seeing now in the U.S., it's inflationary pressure that are strong, and they are broad-based. So not just in specific sectors of the economy, but they're broad-based in the overall economy. We see a very tight labor market, and we see robust wage growth. So there are clearly upside risks to the inflation outlook. So the risk that inflation dynamics may become entrenched, they become part of the wage dynamics, and they lead eventually to a de-anchoring of inflation expectation. So that means that tighter policy, monetary policy, is appropriate, both in terms of policy rate as well as balance sheet normalization, essentially removing the accommodation that has been put in place during the COVID pandemic, that unprecedented monetary policy accommodation. And the Fed, it's on the way. They already hiked the federal fund rate once. They are signaling about starting what they call QT, so quantitative tightening, so shrinking the balance sheet. Now, in real terms, the policy is still quite accommodative, right? So if you look at financial condition in the US, by historical standard, they are still relatively accommodative, despite that some tightening that it's on the way. So the Fed market expect 9 hikes of the policy rate this year, in some sense more than what the Fed has penciled in March. And long rates in the last few days have started to move higher on talks about quantitative tightening. Now, why is this a financial stability risk? I think ultimately that was your question. I think there is a risk of repricing of risk, like in markets, if there is a reassessment on the part of investor of the inflation outlook or the monetary policy outlook. That repricing of risk may lead to a disorderly tightening of financial conditions that could interact with financial vulnerabilities that have emerged during COVID. So, for example, in the public sector, higher debt, we have seen debt going up in the corporate sector, as well as some vulnerability among non-bank financial institutions. So I think that's the risk, right? Mm-hmm. A disorderly tightening of financial condition, interacting with these vulnerabilities, and that could pose a risk to financial stability. Now, obviously, there are differences across country. The U.S. growth appear to be stronger than other advanced economies, for example. Then we have different specific situation in emerging markets. But broadly speaking, I think that's the channel of transmission in terms of financial stability risk.
So what you're saying essentially is high inflation will inevitably result in higher interest rates. And we've already started to see that, as you said. What does that mean for emerging markets and a lot of low income countries that are struggling to service the debt that they've accumulated under COVID, many of them already in debt distress at this point?
Yeah, so emerging market central banks in emerging markets, they already start tightening monetary policy last year, right? So a number of central banks across the emerging market world, they actually raised policy rates and they start unwinding some of the COVID policy to address inflationary pressure that were evident. So yields in emerging markets, in fact, they already start to rise last year. Now, this has direct implication for external financing need. This is a time when such needs have been rising post-COVID. We've seen widening fiscal deficit, higher debt, and a number of vulnerabilities in emerging markets. In fact, there is a chapter in the Global Financial Stability Report that looks exactly at the nexus between sovereign debt and banks. We also seen widening of spreads, particularly post-Russian invasion of Ukraine, although some that widening has, in some sense, reverted, at least in part, in following weeks. Also see, particularly for lower-rated countries, that the widening of spread is particularly evident for lower-rated countries, and we've seen an increase in the number of countries with spreads in distress, what we call above 1,000 basis points. There are also risk of capital flows. Obviously, we have seen ebbs and flows in terms of capital flows. The year has started relatively strong in terms of equities, local currency flows. Those flows have suffered when during the risk-off episode during the war. So with that, we start seeing some improvement lately. And lastly, we do still see differentiation, not just across ratings, so higher rated countries versus lower rated countries, but also in terms of differentiation across countries, right? So if you take, for example, Asian emerging market, inflation pressure are much less evident there. And so the policy path, they have not started hiking the policy rate, central banks in Asia, as, for example, they've done in Latin America and Eastern Europe. So I think that differentiation is something that's important to keep in mind, both in terms of inflation outlook as well as in terms of policy outlook.
Okay, so we have not talked a lot about high commodity prices in quite some time, but they are back. And your report uses the example of nickel. Why nickel, and why have commodity prices generally gone wild recently, and what are the risks associated with that?
I mean, commodity prices, as I mentioned, this has been an important channel of transmission of the war in Ukraine. In some sense, this is what has transmitted and reverberated through the financial sector in terms of increased funding costs, counterparty risk, liquidity. And the macroeconomic important channel is that this is adding to inflationary pressure and central bank challenges that were already evident at the beginning of the year, right? It's like almost there were two teams, right? There was a macro team at the beginning of the year, which was higher inflation, central bank normalization in advanced economies. Then we have seen the war, and at least one of these channels, the commodity price channel, has actually increased pressure in terms of inflation, making that trade-off for central banks even more challenging. Right? Why commodities? Right. So Russia accounts for a substantial share of global production of commodities, particularly gas, oil, platinum, nickel, aluminum, coal, and in Europe, in particular, is exposed to oil and gas from Russia. So part of the disruption and surge in commodity prices is related to sanctions, right? Although some of the sanctions, in fact, have excluded commodities, right? With differentiation across countries. But think of like oil and energy in Europe. Part of it is the market participants' action in response to the global outcry to the war, beyond the sanctions themselves. There's also disruption related to the logistics of commodities markets. I saw shipments that come from specific part of the globe that are involved in the war, or specific logistic issues in terms of like flying over a specific jurisdiction. Now, beyond this immediate disruption also, there are concerns about the geopolitics of energy sources and energy security. So concern that the world of commodity supply may split along geopolitical lines, and that will have persistent impact on commodity prices, right? So in the GFSR, essentially, we focus on an example, the LME and nickel, and part of the work that we did there, and it was in some sense new, has been focusing on the financing side of commodities, right? So the role that dealer banks play in financing the shipment of commodities, for example, through, say, letter of credits from banks, as well as the derivatives side of this, the financing of derivatives. And that's where we have seen significant tensions, at least in some segment, with large margin calls putting pressure on market participants.
And so you just mentioned energy there, and while there still are some shipments going to some countries, it has, I mean, the war in Ukraine has triggered a bit of an energy crisis in terms of supply, and the GFSR suggests this trend could potentially stall efforts to address climate change. How does that work?
So what we are highlighting in the report essentially is the issue of energy security, which is obviously a legitimate issue that we have seen during this war episode, and the possibility that the geopolitics of energy security may put energy transition risk, right? So the idea is that transition to renewable may become more costly, more complex, and potentially disorderly. Now, that becomes a financial stability risk, given that climate change poses a risk to financial stability. Those are financial risks related to a delayed and possibly disorderly climate transition. Now, there may be some setback in the immediate future. For example, some countries have indicated their intention to switch to domestic coal-fired power generation, fossil fuel production, in a way to secure energy needs in the short term. In addition, the buildup of renewable energy infrastructure will require some time. It may face headwinds amid rising prices, supply disruption of critical commodities. Think of cobalt, palladium, nickel. But I think we want to think about the impetus to reduce energy dependency on Russia could also be a catalyst for change, right? Accelerate the transition. I think it's going to be crucial here that policymakers intensify their effort to achieve net zero targets, lever up private finance, including by improving climate data availability and quality, promoting disclosure, so that we can accelerate this transition to a green global economy and use the war as a catalyst for accelerating the change.
So you started out this conversation by saying this wasn't a financial crisis. Mm-hmm. What do policymakers need to be doing now to prevent it from becoming one?
So we have a number of policy recommendations in the report. So in terms of monetary policy, as I said, central bankers are facing a challenging trade-off between fighting inflation and safeguarding the recovery at a time when there is heightened uncertainty about the economic outlook. Now, they need to take decisive action to rein in rising inflation and address financial vulnerabilities while avoiding a disorderly tightening of financial conditions that would jeopardize the economic recovery. So how they do that, they should provide clear guidance about policy normalization processes while at the same time remaining data dependent. So they face challenges to meet their mandates and should be resolute in preventing any perceived damage to their credibility. And to avoid unnecessary volatility in markets, it is crucial that they provide clear guidance about the normalization process. That's our monetary policy. In terms of emerging markets, they remain vulnerable to a tightening of global financial conditions. Of course, there are heterogeneity across emerging markets in terms of inflation outlook, policy response, right? I mentioned it, that, for example, emerging Asia vis-a-vis, say, Latin America or Eastern Europe. Now, it is crucial here to strike a balance between containing the build-up vulnerabilities and avoiding procyclicality, given the huge uncertainty about the economic outlook. And then finally, maybe one lesson on commodity prices. The surge in volatility and dislocation in commodity markets clearly underscored the importance of ensuring the adequacy of disclosure and standard of transparency to counterparties, particularly major financial institutions like large banks. This is essential to support risk management and supervisory oversight and make sure that this doesn't become a financial crisis.
Fabio Natalucci, always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Fabio Natalucci is Deputy Director in the Capital and Monetary Markets Department and heads the Global Financial Stability Report, the latest of which was published today. Check it out at imf.org/GFSR. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.